Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, accepting nominations now for the 2022 James Irvine Foundation Leadership Awards at irvineawards.org. The California Endowment. Health happens when Californians value schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org. And by the California Healthcare Foundation, ensuring the voices of Californians are heard in California's decisions about healthcare. On the web at chcf.org/voices.
From Valley Public Radio, you're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Kathleen Schock. Today on our show, what young Latinas are doing to make up for their missed quinceañeras due to COVID. And later, a student filmmaker connects to his roots by making a documentary on Indian farm protest. But first, Fresno's Cambodian community is playing a key role in the planning of a new exhibit at the Chaffee Zoo. As FM89's Sarith Hawk reports, Kingdoms of Asia is inspired by Cambodia's iconic Angkor Wat.
An animation video previews the Kingdoms of Asia attraction. It's playing on a big screen TV near where the entrance of the exhibit will be.
Entering into Sompaya Square, guests are transported to a lush jungle landscape teeming with sights and sounds.
The entrance is modeled after the famous entrance of Angkor Wat, says Dean Watanabe, Chief Conservation Education Officer at the Fresno Chaffee Zoo.
They have the where the stones are stacked, which is where it gets its really distinctive look and has those really tall features.
At the construction site, he points to the first part of a wall that's been built to replicate the temple's tiered design.
So that building, you can actually see where it's featuring that architecture.
For now, there's a lot of work ahead. A construction crew is busy inside the fenced-off zone. Once finished, it will house 11 species native to Southeast Asia, including orangutans, Komodo dragons, tigers, and sloth bears. The $38 million project comes from Measure Z, a 1/10-cent county sales tax that benefits the zoo.
So the idea was proposed if we themed it after Angkor Wat, which is in Cambodia. And so as we started to really think about it, the idea came, it's like, well, we could do a lot more than just theme an exhibit. We should work with our community here.
For the past 2 years, the zoo has formed a partnership with members of Fresno's Cambodian community. One of them is Samnang Hang, who works at the Holistic Cultural and Educational Wellness Center at the Fresno Center.
To be a part of this, give some input and advice on, especially on about cultural thing, is mean a lot to us.
And there's a lot of pressure to get it right. Angkor Wat is a cornerstone of Cambodian culture, considered one of the most important archaeological sites in Southeast Asia. It was built in the 12th century and was the center of the Khmer Kingdom, revered for its architecture and engineering. Hang has visited Angkor Wat a few times, and he says it's always been a place he's felt connected to.
It really touched my heart when I get there. It's like, wow, this is something that I've been missing as of my childhood.
Hang was born in Cambodia, but was thrust into the horrors of the Khmer Rouge regime as a toddler.
And I was sent off to work in the rice field to chase all those birds out from the rice field so they don't destroy the crop. So after that, we fled to the camp, Thailand camp. So it's, all my childhood has been, it's not really a childhood, you know.
Hang came to the U.S. as a teenager and finally had a chance to go back to Cambodia as an adult. He saw the temple for the first time in 2014, which makes his work now even more significant.
You know, I never thought of this before. Is this something that in a lifetime that I have an opportunity to work with?
Hang has been a liaison to the local Cambodian community, consulting with elders to make sure every detail is accurate and authentic. One of the places of inspiration is Fresno's Cambodian Buthet Satsana Arengse Temple near Clinton and Valentine. Morning chants are just starting as worshippers pray to lost loved ones. Lok Sai Bun Thun is one of the monks here. He was asked to show zoo staff the religious sculptures at the temple.
I explained them the way that we have the Buddha statues.
He points to a statue of Buddha sitting under a large tree on the temple grounds.
And also here, It is the day that he got enlightenment under the Bodhi tree.
Lok Bun Thun walks toward the temple's own construction project underway to build a new front entrance.
You see this kind of animals. It's called like a head of macaw.
There are rows of concrete slabs on the ground, each carved with a dragon called macaw, a powerful mythical creature thought to bring good fortune and protection. Lok Bun Thun says zoo staff were especially interested in the animal carvings that will decorate the gate's arch. They're all details that Dean Watanabe hopes to incorporate into the exhibit.
Looking for those small things that, you know, for most zoo guests, they're not going to notice or they won't know. But for those people that do know, they'll see it and they'll understand the thought that went into the exhibit.
For some Nang Hang, the partnership is a source of pride. And he hopes the exhibit will reach a younger generation of Cambodians, ones who haven't had the chance to see Angkor Wat in person.
I am Cambodian. You know, I'm proud of it. We want our next generation to say that and feel that way.
The first phase of the exhibit will open at the end of this year. The final phase is expected to be completed in 2022. For Valley Public Radio News, I'm Sarith Hawk.
You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Kathleen Schock. Across the Central Valley, young women in the Latinx and Catholic communities celebrate their 15th birthdays with a religious ceremony and party called a quinceañera. FM89's Monty Bolaños has this story of two teenagers whose quinceañeras were interrupted by COVID-19.
Edmila Navarro had been anxiously awaiting her big day. She already had her dress picked out, and her little sisters loved it.
It's gold.
Her sisters sit at the edge of the bed in their apartment in Kettleman City, watching Edmila pull the dress out of its wrapping. The top of the dress is made to fit like a corset, embroidered with gold sequins that flow down the dress in intricate designs. The bottom is filled with layers and layers of tulle. Edmila's mom and older sister didn't have quinceañeras, so she says they were looking forward to celebrating this milestone with her.
Because it was going to be not just like my day, it was going to be their day too.
It was also going to be a special day for her grandmother, Maria Navarro. Navarro lives in the same apartment complex and has watched her daughter raise Edmila and her siblings on her own in the Kings County farming community of 1,100 people.
To have a quinceañera is a total dream for little girls. From a young age, they'll say, I want to have a quinceañera, and it's our responsibility to complete that dream.
In Latino culture, a quinceañera symbolizes a girl's transition into womanhood. The celebration, originated in Mexico, involves a religious ceremony where the young woman promises to model herself after the Virgin Mary. After that, the family throws a party. According to tradition, she changes from flat shoes to heels and from a small to a larger crown.
It's a tradition that we bring here for those who want it, because you only turn 15 once.
So, the Navarro family scheduled Edmila's quinceañera for May 9th, 2020.
That's like the day of my birthday, right? And it was a Saturday. So we're like, oh, well, perfect.
Edmila says not a lot happens in Kettleman City, so she was looking forward to seeing their small community come together for her party. But then the pandemic hit. Edmila says her mom started receiving calls from the church and the DJ they booked, asking her what they planned to do.
Like saying if we were going to have it or not.
They changed the date of the party three times. Edmila says they moved it to August 15th, thinking the pandemic would be under control by then. But it wasn't, so they pushed the party back again to January 9th. Then, her 14-year-old brother, her mom, and her grandmother all contracted COVID-19. Now, with vaccinations becoming more widespread, Edmila rescheduled her party one more time. On a recent afternoon, she goes door to door along with her two younger sisters, mom and grandma, to nearly every home in Kettleman City to drop off invitations.
Hi. 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 Oh, you Yeah, second it is Jasmine's.
Yes. Para que se vayan on Saturday, okay?
Okay, thank you.
Uh-huh, bye.
The front of the invitation reads Sweet 16, but following quinceañera tradition, the back lists the people known as the madrinas and padrinos, or godparents, that help contribute to the upcoming party. She reads the list aloud. Bible and Rosary, Judas Dominguez. Dress, Nevea and Felipe. Crown, Maria Rios. Edmila's cousin, Emily Navarro, is also contributing to the celebration by baking desserts for the party. Emily, who lives in Lemoore, also had to postpone her quinceañera.
I was really sad, and honestly, I didn't even want anything anymore, just because I was like, it wasn't going to feel the same since I'm already 16.
For 2 months, Emily wrestled with whether to reschedule the celebration. But because the dress was already paid for, she says her dad still wanted to do something small. Still, family members pushed Emily's dad to host a bigger celebration when the pandemic was over.
They ended up convincing him and like telling him to do something big. And he has always wanted to do something big since I'm the youngest and basically the only girl.
Emily's party is scheduled for July now so that their extended family can fly in to join the celebration. And Edmila finally had her party last weekend. Instead of a traditional father-daughter dance, Edmila shared the floor with her mom. And the DJ still played a classic quinceañera song, Tiempo de Vals by Cheyenne. The pandemic may have postponed her quinceañera for a year, but she says she was grateful to finally celebrate the day with her sisters, mom, and grandmother. For Valley Public Radio, I'm Mari Bolaños.
This story is part of the Central Valley News Collaborative, which is supported by the Central Valley Community Foundation with technology and training support by Microsoft Corporation. This is Valley Edition. I'm Kathleen Schock. The COVID-19 pandemic has heightened awareness about the connection between race and health equity, raising the question, how might this experience change public health policy moving forward? I explored the topic with Dr. Venice Curry, a health advocate and board member with the Climate Center, Monica Davalos, research associate with the California Budget and Policy Center, and Whitney Pirtle, assistant professor of sociology at UC Merced. So, Monica, I'd like to start with you. The California Budget and Policy Center issued a report in February, and I'm going to quote directly from the report itself. It says, the COVID-19 pandemic has disproportionately impacted Black and Brown communities, exposing the damaging effects of racism in California. This was not by accident, but by design. That's a bold statement. Can you unpack for us how you came to that conclusion?
So we know that the COVID-19 pandemic has really underscored the depth and the reach that racism has on, you know, children, families, and communities of color predominantly, because of the large health disparities that we've seen come out of it, right? Within our report, we did an age adjustment analysis for COVID-19 cases and fatalities, adjusting for age. And then we found that Native Hawaiian and other Pacific Islander, Latinx, multi-race, and Black Californians have really been experiencing the highest rates of COVID-19 deaths and infections after adjusting for age, which is especially alarming because some of these demographic groups are generally younger than other populations. So really, they should not be passing away and being harmed by COVID-19 at the rates that we saw, right? And so our report really looked into kind of the underlying causes of why we see the underlying health conditions and the underlying health disparities within these communities. And ultimately, what we can point to is the legacy and ongoing racist policies and practices that are in all aspects of our lives in the institutions that we interact with on a daily basis.
Whitney Purtle, you've recently written that racial capitalism is a fundamental cause of COVID inequities. What do you mean by that?
So when I'm talking about racial capitalism as a fundamental cause of COVID-19 inequities, what I'm thinking about is this concept that explains how racism and capitalism are mutually intertwined, that they hold each other up. That capitalism exists so some can profit at the expense of others. And these others are usually people of color, and they have been in the United States. So a key example, for instance, is when we're thinking about essential workers, those people who don't have protection like PPE or protection in terms of having time off, who are put in the front lines. And we do see that Black and brown populations are more likely have a higher proportion of representation in these essential jobs. For instance, meat packaging plants in the valley, those who are out in the fields, those who are delivering food, even thinking about DoorDash, those are more likely to be occupied by people of color and have less protections. And so you can see how they have an increased risk for COVID-19. Their labor is very essential. Their sort of humanity and their safety has been devalued. And so I think of racial capitalism as a concept to help us think through these processes that we're seeing right now.
So Dr. Curry, we've been talking about sort of the intersection between race and health disparities as it pertains to COVID-19. But of course, we know that it goes beyond just that one virus. Can you provide some context for us, please?
Sure. Really, what we see with COVID is just really sort of an uncovering of basically what we are already aware of, that there are disparities that exist and that those disparities put people at risk. So at the core of it is structural and institutional racism that affects basically every aspect of life. So it affects your housing, your neighborhoods and the built environment, your educational opportunities, and your access, to quality and affordable public health. So if you're already at risk because of your community not having been built in a way that nurtures you, when there's a virus such as COVID-19, basically what it will do is to reveal what those disparities and those inequities look like. And so when you have pre-existing conditions, in part because your built environment is structured in such a way that your community is a community that has toxic facilities and has excessive truck traffic. So your air quality is poor. And if it's structured so that you have food deserts where you're not able to access fruits and vegetables, it changes your diet, puts you at greater risk for obesity and for diabetes. So you can just sort of see the layering on of factor upon factor so that by the time you have a pandemic where vulnerabilities already exist, what you'll see is just the outcomes that are expected, that people who actually have to be overexposed and are already carrying a heavy burden disease will be the ones who have the worst outcomes. And that's basically what we've seen with communities of color.
So, Monica, the report that the California Budget and Policy Center issued calls for California to declare racism a public health crisis. And that's something that has happened in some cities, in some communities, although not so much in the Central Valley. I'd love for you to talk more about the significance of that kind of a declaration. Is it a symbolic move, or do you see that as being something that could meaningfully have an impact for people's lives?
I think that's a great question. So we see declaring racism as a public health crisis as really the important first step in addressing racism and advancing racial equity in California for two main reasons. And one, in order for policymakers and our leaders to actually solve a problem rather than treat the symptoms, we really need to define it, which California has not yet to do. And, even declaring racism as a public health crisis, California wouldn't be the first state to do that. And secondly, is that declarations are often the first step in prompting policy action and the allocation of resources to address any major issue.
Whitney Pirtle, I'd be interested in hearing your thoughts about what you would like to see take place from a policy perspective to address some of these systemic inequities in our systems.
Sure. Thank you. And if I could just add to what Monica was saying about identifying racism as a cause of health inequities, I think naming racism can be very important, as she says, because it removes the focus on the individual, which oftentimes we then center this idea that there are racial differences in biological health outcomes, and we use race as sort of a scapegoat. But when you say that it's racism as a system that causes these inequities, we look beyond the individuals and look to our institutions, our organizations, and our policies. And I think that's really, really important, not only for thinking through solutions, but also important so we don't get this mystical idea about what race is and what it means for our bodies, because our bodies are not, racial differences are not biological, they are social in the construction and how they are manifested. In terms of your second question about policies, I think when we identify racial capitalism or structural racism as a fundamental cause of health inequities, what that means is we have to look at what's beneath the surface in order to fundamentally change the patterns that we have seen. And so for me, policies need to be big in nature. They need to think about increasing access to health care. That matters for where we're putting hospitals and doctor's office. That means increasing basic income that people have so they can help, you know, build up their health behaviors. That means addressing food deserts and making sure our policies in terms of urban planning is more equitable. It means maybe increasing access to, you know, maybe even universal health care, or trying to model that type of system in California. I think we really need to see a big change, and so we need some big solutions that really get at the fundamental root cause of all social inequities so we can address health inequities as well.
Dr. Curry, you've been doing so much advocacy and work in this space. Can you talk about what kinds of responses have been effective and trying to address some of these gaps in equity? What's happening on the ground that's working?
Yeah, thank you for that question. Part of the work that I've done is community organizing, which is a very basic level of partnering with community members who are the most impacted, really to share information and also develop creative solutions. Just as it was mentioned, you know, this is not about individual differences between people. It is about structure and institution and the way that those institutions sustain a system that creates division, creates inequity, and then sustains it in a way that is perpetrating and really creating the outcomes that we see. And so community organizing is one way of developing communities' voice and power, and also addressing policy changes that are really needed and are structural. And so people often say, you know, you want to change hearts and minds. No, you really want to change policy, and you want to change the way that policy is put in place with equity at the core. But you want to change the implementation so that it actually is an equitable distribution of not only resources and investment, but that there's an outcome that says however people think, the goal is that we would reduce, for instance, infant mortality. We know that in Fresno County, for instance, the infant mortality rate for African Americans is oftentimes double what it appears for other nationalities, and that has been consistent. And so there's a lack of will in wanting to change policy to match what is needed. And part of that strategy has to be that, you know, there are more warriors on the field to really fight this battle. So policy changes, shifting the resources, can only come when people actually have to do something different, because people don't just volunteer to sort of change the direction they're going in. And so a lot of that community organizing really is focused on the policy change, the implementation, the actual pivoting to something that actually works for the folks who are most impacted.
So before we wrap up, I'd like to have all of you take a moment to weigh in on this next question. You know, we're sort of approaching the end of this pandemic. And as we reflect back on what we have been through collectively as a society, I'm curious what your thoughts are about what lessons we have learned about race and health inequities as a result of COVID-19. And Monica, we'll go ahead and start with you. What lessons have we learned, or have we learned any?
Honestly, I think we've, as a society, have maybe just learned more about the experiences that communities of color already go through and are already very well aware of, right? But the COVID-19 pandemic really exacerbated the problems and brought them to light. And, you know, additionally, I think we also learned that public health is, you know, affects everyone, and everyone is much more aware of the impact that it has on their lives, and also that we really need to build up our public health systems before another crisis hits. And even now, right, unfortunately, the governor's most recent proposed budget that came out last week did not actually include new ongoing investments for public health departments that were outside of COVID-19. And, you know, we know that this is likely to come at the cost of ongoing public health outreach and prevention efforts, especially for communities of color and low-income communities that really need it the most. And so, yeah, I think going forward, we need to take seriously what we learned throughout this pandemic.
Whitney, your thoughts?
I hope that we have learned that unless we address inequality in our society overall, we will always have inequalities and inequities in our health outcomes. I think that is really important to the point that health equity is correlated with educational equity, with housing equity, with food equity, that we really need to think about this as a whole systems approach and think about solutions from that point of view as well. And I think when we're thinking about if we are at the end of the pandemic or what, you know, if we're moving towards the end and we're thinking about vaccinations, I think that can teach us another important lesson in that this is one of the first times many of our generations have had access to a healthcare intervention in our local communities, that we could show up for an appointment without, you know, providing insurance information if needed and get some really important healthcare treatment. And I think if we think about how we are able to distribute and do that even more equitably, how we can increase public health on a broader scale. So I think the lessons are about, you know, what equity means and how that's attached to access and where we want to put our money and time to make sure those things are connected with one another.
And Dr. Venice Curry, I'm going to give you the last word. What, if anything, have we learned?
Honestly, I'm not certain that we've learned that much. I think the people who have been most impacted by health inequities were not surprised at the outcomes. And so I don't know that as a larger community and society that we've learned that there is this interconnectedness that puts us all at risk if some of us are hurting. And so that concept, I think, is still out of reach for some. But that leaves room for movement, but it also continues to be a risky portion, a risky situation for us all. I think that what we can see, and we can use this opportunity, is to think about being creative and innovative in our restructuring of institutions, beginning with public health. And if we use just one aspect of this crisis to think about what equity would have looked like and how we might have been more efficient with time and resources, had we not allowed some people to be treated as disposable, would the outcry and would the response have been different had it not been that Black and brown people were seemingly succumbing much quicker? And so I think there are economic issues as well as moral and humanity issues that we could grapple with, but I don't think that people are necessarily at the point where they want to see this more than just an episode in our lives. So I'm not technically as optimistic about lessons learned, but I think that we collectively, if there is critical mass, that we could use this as an opportunity to really drill down on examining racial inequity at its core and moving to create systems that actually center equity and then describe what that looks like behaviorally and outcome-wise, and sort of grapple with the transformative places that people need to be in order to actually realize it. But operationalizing the outcomes and just saying as a target, we would reduce infant mortality as a symptom. And in order to do that, we'd have to work backwards. We'd have to create policy. We would have to reorder our distribution of resources. And in order to do that, there's a needed will. And what does it take to get that will operable? So I don't think we've learned the lessons, but I think we still can. And I just want to add that, you know, as much as the health problem is there, the climate change and what that will do in terms of driving other pandemics, we don't want to lose sight of how we have an opportunity to prepare and whether or not we take the opportunity or not.
Well, thank you all so much for being on the panel today. This has been a really important conversation. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Kathleen Schock. Months after the COVID-19 vaccine first became available in the U.S., it has now been approved in adolescents 12 and older. So should your kids get it? Pediatricians resoundingly say yes. And FM89's Carrie Klein explores why as part of this week's COVID update. Carrie, welcome back.
Thanks, Kathleen.
First, as usual, let's begin with our Valley-wide snapshot for the last week.
Well, as usual, the numbers are looking really good. So new cases in our area are hovering around 150 per day, and deaths are slowly falling. Around 20 new deaths were reported in the last week, which is an order of magnitude lower than during the winter surge earlier this year. So that's great. Hospitals, too, continue to slowly empty out of COVID patients. And when it comes to business reopenings, all counties in our area are in the same tier as they were last week, all in the orange tier except for Merced, which is still in red. However, the pace of vaccinations continues to slow, as we began reporting on weeks ago. And for the last few weeks, only about 1% of the population has gotten their vaccine each week. This brings us to 28% of our region who are fully vaccinated and another 8% partially vaccinated. That's still something, but we have the healthcare capacity for many, many more vaccines every week.
Now, when we ran this segment last week, it was only a day after the CDC had relaxed masking guidelines for people who'd been fully vaccinated. That seemed straightforward enough, but it's generated a lot of controversy. What's the latest?
Right. Well, so after that announcement last Thursday, lots of doctors and health experts and health associations came out and said those guidelines were premature and lacked context for people. And so some of those arguments include the fact that lots of people who haven't been vaccinated will gladly remove their masks, even though they technically haven't been given the green light to, and there's no way to verify, of course. Also, children under 12 are not eligible to be vaccinated yet, and they could still contract the virus from someone who either hasn't been vaccinated or possibly they have been vaccinated but are still carrying it. And then, of course, you know, the virus could then circulate in schools. You know, Dr. Anthony Fauci of the CDC has come out and said the guidelines were intended to make people feel safe once they'd been vaccinated. But many who decry those guidelines fear that damage has already been done and there's no way to walk that decision back.
As we said earlier, we just finished the first full week that children 12 and older have been able to receive the Pfizer vaccine. Just as with adults, many folks are reluctant to vaccinate their kids. But Carrie, I understand you spoke with a local pediatrician this week. What's her take on expanded vaccine eligibility?
Yeah, so I spoke with Dr. Ann Van Garcy. She's an associate dean of the New College of Osteopathic Medicine at California Health Sciences University in Clovis, and she's a pediatrician by training. And her response to adolescent eligibility to the vaccine is categorical. She's thrilled as both a doctor and a mother. She says she's been evangelizing the vaccine to her family since it first became available.
I feel that strongly in it that I encouraged my own father to go. I encouraged my husband to go. I took two of my children to go. So yes, I believe in it. I wouldn't have gotten it myself and gotten it for all my family if I had any concerns about it at all.
And she's looking forward to when her youngest child, a 10-year-old, will also be eligible.
Very early on, data showed globally that children are at lower risk of infection and severe disease than adults. Why does Van Garsie say it's important to vaccinate this age group?
Well, there are two main reasons. One is that kids can still transmit the disease. So they may have mild symptoms or none at all, but they can still carry it from, say, the classroom back home to their elderly grandfather. And so the vaccine could help prevent that transmission. The second reason is that even though the risk may be lower, it's still there. As of earlier this month, 127 adolescents in the 12 to 17 age group had died of COVID so far. That's across the entire United States. And so that number may pale in comparison to the more than 500,000 deaths in total. But remember, that age group has a very low death rate overall. And so that total is actually really significant.
That 127 does make COVID-19 actually in the top 10 causes of death in the United States for adolescents. So car accidents, you know, suicide, gun violence, all of those things, it's in the same category as all of that. So all causes of death total, COVID-19 is in the top 10.
But then, of course, death is not the only bad outcome in children. There's also that mysterious inflammatory disease with unknown long-term consequences.
Yeah, that's known as multisystem inflammatory syndrome in children, or MISC, and it affects an order of magnitude more children than who have died of COVID-19. In this next audio clip, Van Garsie uses the term sequelae. It really just means health outcomes.
That affects many different organ systems in children, including the heart, the brain, the kidneys, the GI system, the eyes, that sort of thing. We've had over 3,700 cases of that since the pandemic started. And that's terrifying because even though the patients didn't all die of it, we don't know what the long-term sequelae of that are going to be for their heart, for their brains. You know, what kind of long-term health problems are we going to have?
So from what we know so far, how well does the vaccine work in adolescents?
It appears to work incredibly well. I mean, if you recall the original clinical trials of the Pfizer vaccine, it was reportedly around 94% effective in adults. In adolescents, clinical trials showed it was 100% effective. Not a single kid who got the vaccine developed COVID afterward.
We do know that actually their immune response has been better than in adults, which is not surprising. We expected that, right? They're a young, healthy population who not only have had a lot more recent of vaccines than a lot of us adults, but also have, you know, are on the tail end of having a lot more infectious diseases in general, because, you know, typically as kids go through preschool and school age, they meet a lot of viruses and their immune system gets educated about those viruses on the regular.
The most common side effects among adolescents are reportedly the same as in adults, you know, achiness, fatigue, chills, and fever. They might even be more common among adolescents than adults because their immune systems react more strongly. Anaphylaxis did also occur in rare cases, which is why vaccine sites must still observe everyone for 15 minutes after their shots, and a doctor must always be present at the clinic.
But just as many worry that clinical trials in adults were too short, many others worry that the clinical trials in adolescents were too small. What does Van Garsie say about these clinical trials in kids?
Well, it's true that the size of these trials was a lot smaller. You know, about 3,000 adolescents were enrolled in clinical trials versus more than 40,000 participants in adult trials. But Van Garsie says that's because as long as a vaccine is safe and effective in adults, you typically expect the results to be that good or better in kids. And besides, at this point, 280 million doses have been administered throughout the U.S., and of those, 4 million were in kids. And so, however small people may feel the clinical trials were, there is now real-life data to back up how safe and effective these vaccines are.
Got it. Well, Carrie, thank you so much.
Thank you, Kathleen.
This is Valley Edition. I'm Kathleen Schock. Since January, a group of San Joaquin Valley High School students have been part of the CMAC Youth Voices documentary filmmaking training program. Their films, which range in topics from immigration to the digital divide, debut Sunday at 1 p.m. in a virtual film screening. I spoke with one of the students, Ishan Singh. He's a junior at Sunnyside High School in Fresno, and his documentary is about Indian farm protest. Lisa Talley, one of the coordinators of the training program, also joined in the conversation. Lisa, these films were produced by students who went through a 14-week training program. What did that consist of?
So the training curriculum started with identifying the story. I think that's the hardest thing to doing any documentary, any production really, but in documentary especially, is identifying the story, identifying the issue and the purpose of why you want to tell the story. It's easy to get lost in the weeds once production schedules are completed, interviews start rolling in, you're collecting a lot of data, and the deeper you get, the easier it is to fall off track. And so if you start with purpose, you start with the story, it's going to act like a compass as you move through it. And so that was the first thing we really tackled, was figuring out each student figuring out what story they wanted to tell and why they were telling it. And then as we continued down the 14-week training, it started to get a little bit more technical. And so it started to become also more practical. They were creating their own production schedules, and each of them were running their own teams. They had to be a team of one. So they were running every aspect of production. And so it was creating the schedules, identifying who could help them tell that story as interview guests. Then it was developing the questions, conducting the interviews, collecting the data, the B-roll, which is the cutaways, the extra footage, the visuals, any music, photos, additional research, and then putting it all together. So editing in, you know, editing software, video editing software to complete it all. So we spent 14 weeks doing that, and a lot of them, they hadn't done this before. And so it was sort of like building the road as they were running on it. And it was, that was... probably in a nutshell, the journey that they were on over the 14 weeks.
Ishan, tell me about how you came to your story topic and what the process was like for you producing your film.
Yeah, absolutely. So when I first got introduced and inducted into the program, I at the time had been focusing a lot in my personal life about student youth voices and advocacy. I was getting involved in different organizations where I could help represent my voice and student voice. So when I first got into the program, that was going to be the initial topic that I wanted to discuss. I wanted to boost upon whatever I knew at that time and just not only consolidate the knowledge for myself, but also provide knowledge for others. But over time, as much as that personally affected me too, a lot of stuff happened in my own personal life in my own home country of India, where I tie my roots back to. And it all related to the same aspect of just human rights and voices. At the time, throughout this whole process, I heard about the farmer protests that were occurring in India. And these events were something that deeply touched upon my family. I'm a Sikh Punjabi individual who comes from a long line of farmers. And like, India is a place where my heritage, my whole existence came to start. And so just seeing the lack of voices, the lack of appreciation that was occurring, I felt helpless that I couldn't do anything. During a time of the pandemic, I couldn't necessarily travel abroad and go fight for my people, fight for human rights. But having the Youth Voices program and being inducted into that, I found an opportunity to do just that, to have my voice and the voices of others be heard. And so I took that as an opportunity of just giving back to the world, but also fulfilling my personal lead of just having recognition occur. So that was one of the biggest things that allowed me to choose my story, just personal experiences that I was going through and having the desire to want to be heard.
And that must have been an incredibly cathartic experience for you working on the film.
Yeah, it absolutely was. So much stuff is happening across the world, and it gets so hard when you can't tell everybody's story, because I believe everybody's story deserves to be heard. We all have a power within our words, but it gets really difficult when you can't have all the pain, suffering, but still all the activism that deserves to be recognized, when you can't get that recognized where it should.
And then what were some of the challenges that you faced over the course of production?
Yeah, so technicality wise, being in the midst of a whole pandemic, not having in-person resources. I know for me, especially like, my entire documentary, everything that I was focusing on, was focused on in a broad country of India. I couldn't necessarily travel to India as much as I would have loved to, and I possibly could. Just not having the exact firsthand experience of what was actually happening. I had to do everything online, getting my sources, getting information. I had to do my own research. I couldn't necessarily diverge myself into the process as much as I wanted to. But even as much as this was a struggle, I ended up learning a lot from it. And I got to see how you don't necessarily have to be within the country to have voices be heard. A lot can be happening in your own community that's just as impactful and as powerful. And so with that challenge that I had, I found many other benefits and positivities that came from it.
So Lisa, tell us a little bit about some of the other films that were produced as part of this year's cohort.
Some of the other documentaries focused on issues like farm workers in the Central Valley and their day-to-day life and the struggles they encounter, LGBTQ plus visibility, the importance of pronouns, how they are part of a person's identity, and it's not a preference. And bisexual visibility is another topic. There's also other documentaries that cover the homelessness crisis in the Central Valley and focus specifically more in the Visalia area. And then we have, you know, of course, Ishan's farmers protest in India. There are documentaries about overcoming struggles of achieving your dreams, whether it's a business or personal goals. I mean, it's a very wide spectrum of topics and interests and issues relevant to the Central Valley.
Lisa, I understand that as part of the training that you did with the students, media literacy was part of that program. Why was it important for you to include media literacy in the curriculum?
So media literacy has been something we've, as an organization, CMAC has been putting a lot of emphasis on, and it's really just our part in helping producers be more responsible producers in thinking about the content that they're creating. So not just what they're consuming, but what they're creating. So for the students, it was important that as they started to structure their story and they were writing out their scripts, their voiceovers, and then developing their questions, it was important for us to talk about the way that they were asking questions and what kind of answers that they were looking for and how relevant those answers would be to the topics that they've chosen. And also identifying, it's part also goes hand in hand in choosing their purpose, is if the purpose is to create awareness, if the purpose was to have sympathy for the topic or the issues that are going on, the way that you ask questions to get to elicit those kinds of answers, it's very particular. And you have to sort of be mindful either politically around the issues, you have to be mindful of the approach that you take, the tone and everything to try to wrap that all together and to present the message that you've set out to tell. So media literacy is not just about addressing before, it's not just about consuming it, but also producing it so that we're responsible and we also stay close to the purpose we set out in telling this story.
So this virtual event is taking place Sunday at 1 p.m. How can people watch?
So people can view this, of course, from home on YouTube. The link is available on CMAC's website, cmac.tv/ Youth Voices. And as it streams on YouTube, if you stick around towards the end and you can either leave a comment, a question, or utilize the chat feature, you can engage with the filmmakers. You're also going to be there at the end to hold a Q&A session to answer questions about their filmmaking process and about their film.
Well, I've been talking with Ishan Singh and Lisa Talley from CMAC about the CMAC Youth Voices film screening. Thank you both so much for being on the show.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you for having us as well.
I have felt heartbreak. I have felt infuriated. I have felt sad. I have grieved.
You're hearing the words of Nandeep Singh, the executive director of the Chikara Movement, a volunteer training organization and hub for sick Californian youth. Singh has joined us as part of our series, looking at how people are processing the magnitude of this pandemic. He spoke with FM89's Alice Daniel, and she produced this audio postcard.
I have been inspired by people coming together. I have felt weary. I have felt rejuvenated in the last year. I think their range of emotions could go any which way on any given day in any given hour. Illness, death, fear was absolutely all around. I mean, especially just being engaged in the community, you know, very early on, I was getting phone calls from those that were becoming hospitalized about the lack of language access, especially because relatives were no longer able to go with their family members to the hospitals. Throughout the state, people were calling, sharing about the problems about language access, how sometimes initially one family member who would contract the virus would end up spreading it because they were just never given the proper information when they were going home. Once we began to understand how the COVID-19 was to be spread, we immediately began hearing from members of our community, especially the children of family members that worked at Foster Farms, Cargill, Pittman Farms, Harris Ranch, and others, especially in the meat and poultry plant industries. And we knew that the conditions of their work were going to be especially conducive to the spread of this virus. And so we immediately began alerting. And I think that was also infuriating because we were trying to be ahead and really try to partner in some ways with actually some of these larger corporations that employ so many of our family members here in the Central Valley about what is going to be happening. More often than not, we were told to stay in our lane. This doesn't concern us, that every action that can be done would be done. But that was never anything that we heard on the ground throughout the Central Valley, whether that be in Fresno County, Merced County, Stanislaus County, or even families we work with down in Kern County. I've had to attend a large number of funerals, especially in December and January of 2020 and 2021. And it's just been so much of this could have been prevented, and largely because of social inequities that were already baked within the system that have only been amplified even further. I think I'm processing in different ways. So structurally, I'm really thinking a lot about questions of public health. I think for the first time that I can think of, people are really trying to center public health and the social determinants of health in a more holistic way. I think new partnerships, new conversations, I think tied to the Black Lives Matter in terms of which communities are most affected. We're having a larger conversation that needed to be had, that W.E.B. Du Bois maybe was having over a century ago when he was publishing initial studies linking questions of economics to health, race and health, and even gender and health. On a personal level, I'm just trying to live a life with a little bit more humility, a little bit more gratitude, a little bit more warmth, giving people the benefit of the doubt a little bit more, and just trying to appreciate those that are in my life that make an impact, and maybe just those that are around me that I draw from, even when I don't connect with them as much as I'd like.
And that's today's Valley Edition. You can hear all this and more on our website, kvpr.org. You can also download the podcast and find us on Twitter and Facebook. We've got an app. It's called KVPR. The show is produced by our news team, including Alice Daniel, Carrie Klein, Madi Bolaños, and Sarith Hawk. Technical support is from Marv Allen and Don Weaver. I'm your host, Kathleen Schock. Thanks for listening.
Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, accepting nominations now for the 2022 James Irvine Foundation Leadership Awards at irvineawards.org. The California Endowment. Health happens when Californians value schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org. And by the California Healthcare Foundation, ensuring the voices of Californians are heard in Californians' decisions about healthcare. On the web at chcf.org/voices.